Hi, my name is Tsepang, like they said. So I'm going to talk about the steps that are taken when you build a robust executable. Okay. I propose this talk knowing that it was rather ambitious because I've never worked on a compiler before, so at this point, if I get any of the details right, it would be good if some of the more knowledgeable people can approach me afterwards. But otherwise, yeah, just a bit of a disclaimer. So, interestingly, I just wanted to mention it. I met two people yesterday actually who are like, let's say, way ahead. I met somebody who works on a V8, who used to work on a V8 engine with the Google team, another one who's a macro expert, which was quite interesting because they were talking about some of the steps. Like, wow, actually, those are the people who should actually give the talk. But about me, I studied electronics formally, and yeah, I was a Python fan for a while, but now, for some reason, I chose Rust. I actually don't even remember why, but I actually quite enjoy it. I think it's very, very well designed. Yeah, I work for a small team in Johannesburg. We built a distributed data framework. It would actually be interesting to know what other companies on the continents do something like this, where they actually have full-time Rust developers working on in production. So, yeah. Anyways, yeah. Let's get to the steps. So, this is sort of an overview. This is what happens when you actually get to produce a working executable. If you look at that, the first step is actually passing the source code. And then when you pass the source code, you produce what is called an AST. It's called an abstract syntax tree. And the second step there is AST processing. I actually don't know what the correct term for what is. I'm going to show you what's going on actually with AST process, but I don't know what is the normal name for the steps involved. But yeah, somebody can tell me a bit later. And anyway, so there's a few steps there: lowering, HIR, type checking, lowering to MIR, borrow checking, translation to LLVM, IR, code generation, linking. We'll get to all those. So first step is passing. So with passing, the source code is turned into something like a meaningful structure. So it just takes raw text and then turns into something meaningful, which is called the AST. And example, it creates a bunch of parts called tokens. And this is just a few examples. The NAC, struct field, word loss, block, or whatever. There's actually like a bunch of them, like dozens. And what you see there, what's written there is actually type names in the compiler, which is like, they are actually internal details. They can change anytime. Nobody should rely on this kind of code. But there's the kind of things that I came across as I was looking at this. And yeah, okay. So we're done with passing, and then we get to AST processing. So there's a bunch of, once you actually have that AST, there are things that you do to it. Example is code elimination. And then we'll get to those, and then macro expansion, name resolution. Note that this, they are not necessarily sequential, as in one happens and then one like you don't do content elimination and then macro expansion and then name resolution. Like they are sort of interchangeable. So you actually have to look at the code to know exactly what the steps are. Yeah, so talking about code elimination, this is, if you have a C, C++ background, this is where the if defs, they're like, it's like an equivalent of if defs where, yeah, this is code, what is that? They call it code conditional compilation. So that is where you're in your C++, C, C++, you get your if defs and things like that. So it is nice because code conditional compilation is nice because we can keep everything in one code base. You don't have to have, okay, this part is actually for this architecture, this part is another category. You can just have them in the code, which simplifies, I guess, debugging. It's also nicer when things that are related are in one place. Yeah, and here's an example of conditional compilation where you'd use a CFG as an example where you want to compile code for Windows. In such a case, okay, let's just look at an example. This is an example from some code that I actually wrote from some crate. So what you'll see that is that you see that second line there. That second line there says CFG Windows. It means that ANSI term enable ANSI support and rep will not compile on Linux. So whenever you build this for Linux, not compile on Linux, but compile for Linux, because remember we have cross compilation. So what's happening there is that when you compile for Linux, it's going to be like that. That code does not exist, that ANSI term. So it's only useful for Windows. So the reason I actually did this is to add color support for Windows. It's like by default, you don't actually get color out of it. So you have to do, it feels like a hack actually. You have to do something like this because Windows is quite different from Unix, right? Anyways, moving on. And then remember there's a few steps. There's now macro expansion, which is kind of a big topic. So there's three forms that I came across. There's a derive, which is one example of a derive macro is when you want to automatically print out debug information from your code. So all you do, you just do, for example, a derive debug, and then whenever you print line that and then tell it to give you debug information, you get all of these things for free. That is one example. And then you get the second example, which is function-like. This one is quite common. Everybody comes across it. Big example is the print line. That's also a macro. And then you also have the attribute form, which is I encounter it when I write code with struct-opt, which I'm actually a fan of. Struct-opt is a crate that's actually built on top of Clap, which does command line interface passing. Anyways, so here's an example of a macro expansion. So you have an asset there, asset EQ. This actually makes your code panic. For example, if your things are not, the things that you are comparing are not equal, so this one will definitely succeed because we all know and believe that one equals one, right? So anyways, and then this is actually what happens. So macro expansion takes that bit of code and then creates this, and this is actually just a snippet of it. It's quite hard to read, right? But yeah, this is what's given. You can try to make sense of what's happening. Like you can see there, for example, it's a match statement. You're comparing left and right values, and it's going to panic with a message, with that message that you see assertion failed if there's problems. Well, if both sides are not equal. Anyways, moving on to with macro expansion. Here's an example from struct-opt. You see, you get simple, nice code like that, that actually gets degenerated into this. This is sort of beautified because the stuff is all over the place. So I just put it together for readability. So basically, you are telling it to accept a long option. A long option is that thing in command line interfaces where you do like a dash dash. So if you're gonna give the command, for example, blah command dash dash ignore untracked, and then you basically create that variable called ignore untracked, and then this is the one that's gonna tell you that it's actually defined on the command line, and then you can act on it, and that's the help string, and then this is pretty much the code that it generates. She's quite less comfortable to type, but there it is. So yeah, this is a macro expansion. Those are just small examples of what's happening. Okay. So this is another step. It's called name resolution. So Rust allows you to use the same names for like multiple things, like things that are not the same type. Like this is pretty much for convenience. I mean, if you take a look at that example, you see we use the same name X for multiple things. We create a type called X, and then we create a variable called X as well. That will actually compile. So what name resolution does, it looks at that code and then notices that they are actually not the same thing. So it's gonna give them different names. Pretty much what it does. I actually took this example from the compiler guide. It's called the Rust guide or something like that. Okay. So it does also variable shadowing. You know what variable shadowing is you can, for example, add on to that and say let y is equals to whatever type or even the same type or whatever, and then the compiler accepts it. So it handles cases like that. Not all languages can handle that, by the way, which I find quite convenient. And then it will also do things, because it knows about names, it's going to do things like typo fixes. Like it can tell if your variable name is maybe close to another one that is in scope, and then it's gonna give you that. And then it also gives you suggestions for traits to import. You've seen how Rust error message, how good they are. They actually give you those kinds of suggestions, like where you try to use a type, but you don't actually have a trait that defines that type. Yeah, you don't have the trait that it defines that type in scope. So it will give you suggestions for that, which is quite cool. Okay. Anyways, moving on. So from the AST, there is a step called lowering. Anyways, what it does, it lowers to HIR. HIR is a high-level intermediate representation of the compiler. So it sort of takes your Rust code and then removes all of the conveniences, all of the sugar and things like that. And then it takes it into sort of a raw form, which is easier to process for your compiler. So like I said, yeah, the AST is converted into HIR. And then HIR is also where type checking is quite important. Type checking happens because, yeah, it's easier to work on something, a more simple representation. So these are just the commands. If you wanted to see the output of what HIR looks like, that's what the commands look like. So you'll give it, you go into your create directory and then run that HIR, and you'll later see what the output actually looks like. I don't know why they use the name unpretty, actually. And I don't think it has to do with the look of the code. It's quite curious. Anyways, moving on. I want to digress just a little bit and talk about RISC-V. RISC-V is a target that I chose for the output of the code, because I wanted to learn a bit more about it. It's actually a new ISA. ISA is actually an instruction set architecture. ISA is like an example of a ISA. I think the most famous is x86. And you also have ARM. So RISC-V is like a sort of a newborn competitor in the field. So I find it nice because I like the, well, reading the motivation for it actually. The design is good, and the people actually learn from them, from issues in the design of the alternative ISAs. So, which is cool. It's also Libre, so you don't have to pay royalties and licensing fees and things like that to use it, which is actually cool. It allows because it allows a lot of people. Well, you must be motivated, right? But it allows a lot of people to actually participate in processor design, which normally you actually have to pay a hefty fee or whatever to be able to do it. So, it also fosters innovation, right? I mean, if you look at open source, for example, which was an inspiration for make part of the inspiration of making it open. So, I wanted also to note that there is Rust support, of course, for RISC-V, but it doesn't have lib standard support. So you won't be able, for example, to run it on Linux. So it's all bare metal at the moment. Okay, so sort of an intro to RISC-V. There's three basic forms. So there's a 32-bit, 64-bit, 128-bit, and yeah, these are called instruction sets, base instruction sets. These are the things that you have to implement for it to be called the RISC-V, because there's actually a standard out there. And then everything else, it's a modular design, so everything else is optional. You only need to implement these things, and everything else, for example, you can actually simulate it if you want more abilities, you know, like for example, multiplication and things like that. So anyway, so this instruction provides some basic things like memory reads, writes. These are actually assembly instructions, simple arithmetic, additional subtraction, logical operations like your ends and ors, and then branching. Branching, yeah, is like jumping to other instructions because you can't just have sequential code, right? I mean, how do you do loops? So anyways, the difference between the three, you'll find that for the 64-bit version will have a bit more instructions which allow you to operate on bigger data, similarly to 120. That's the basic difference. And then finally, so like I said, Rust does support the RISC-V target, and there's actually two of them, which is that RISC-32-IMEC, RISC-V32-IMC. And then those are some of the explanations. So I is that base one, M is a multiply, and A is atomic, C compressed. So again, what this means is that it allows you an option. There would be, for example, if you wanted to build a processor that where you don't care about floating points, which, by the way, Rust does not support, because that one would be a big F. If you don't care about floating point, you just build your processor. You don't have to rely on somebody who built an entire processor, and you only need a small part of it or something like that. Okay, anyways, let's just look at a little bit of code. This is just sample code that I want to use, so you can actually have a look at some of the output. Yeah, I chose something simple because the output at those intermediate and final expanded layers is actually quite ridiculous. It's actually quite hard to read, so it makes you appreciate using a high level language, because yeah, it's it's quite a bit. So anyways, because even this small example is quite big. Okay, so anyways, So that is example HR output. For example, you'll see that it added a little bit of code there, you know, like for example, the prelude, which you normally don't see, so which is actually a convenience that Rust gives you, but automatically adds it there. You'll see create core, for example, we can access the core library, compiler built-ins, which gives you some nice features. Anyway, so what happens during the HR stage? You get important things like type inference, type checking, trait resolution. So yeah, the list is not comprehensive. To see through detail, you actually have to look at the HIRT, which is like super, super detailed. And then we'll have a look. No, we won't have a look. It was way too big. And anyways, what am I skipping? Oh yeah, again, that's just the command if you wanted to actually have a look at it. I mean, it's quite massive, but it sort of gives you some insight into how things are broken up. So anyways, so the next step is that the HIR is turned into what is called the MIR, which is medium because it sits between the HIR and LLVM IR. IR is also intermediate representation, which is how the LLVM represents the code. So it's like sort of the lowest level. So this is like, yeah, medium. So there's also, it's also the concepts are also simplified even further here, where, for example, your matches are removed and your loops are removed, and then you have to use a go-to, for example, which is actually closer to how assembly actually represents it. Anyways, what happens on MIR? Something quite important, actually, which is borrow checking, which is like a critical part of what makes Rust special, right? Where you actually do memory management, but at compile time. So that gives you safety. I mean, there's a few things that it checks for, like variables can be used uninitialized or whatever, right? And what else? It does some pre-optimization so that LLVM will have an easier time actually doing its own optimization, because it understands, because it's Rust, right? It understands itself more than LLVM will. So yeah, the output is LLVM IR. And then that is example of what MIR output looks like, which is, you can tell that the interesting one is actually that BB0 block, where you'll see, if you have a look there, __1_1 is actually your argument. Then what you do, that check multiplication, you multiply that 2 and 3, and then there's some magical asset that inserted for you for overflow checking and things like that. So there we go. And then this is just simple LLVM IR output. It is quite massive, so I only choose a more sort of meaningful example, which is represents what happens there. If you see there, there's a multiply there happening, and I don't know what extract values does and all of that. I think it's a whole talk by itself. But yeah, it was just interesting looking at what it looks like. And then finally, you get to see what the assembly looks like. So if you look at main there, you'll see, I should have put some example code here. You'll see that I was actually giving 1983, which is an arbitrary number. And remember, I was actually giving it, it was an argument to a function call, and then that is what's happening. So basically, you take 1983, put it in a register called A0, and then you'll see that after that, you actually call a function called square. And then if you ignore some of those things, you'll see the instruction called MUL. That's where the multiply actually happens. So remember that A0 is just one, right? What that does is that into register called A1, put the result of the multiplication of these two registers, which is A0. And A0 is what, 1983. And you can ignore the rest of the detail. The total generated assembly was like 120 lines. And yeah, note that I didn't go as far as doing optimized code because that part I don't know. I don't understand the steps. I thought, okay, no, I will ignore this. Anyways, so the very final step is actually that LLVM takes that code, generates binaries, and then in the end, it actually does the linking where it takes all of the various dependencies and things like that. There were dozens, even with the small examples, and then finally produces an executable. And know that this is not the only one, it's not unique. Rust, I'm not sure if it does it now, but with examples that I played with, you would need a linker by a linker from the GNU toolchain, which is binary utils. So yeah, thanks. It was good. It was sort of easy to learn this things because there's a guide. It's a RASI guide, which is actually a new project. This I think it was introduced this year, so I learned some things there. And then I wanted to also give special thanks to RASFest Paris for inspiring me to give a talk. And yeah, RAS team is amazing, of course. And yeah, and then RAS in 10 slides. Thanks to Steve for actually producing that, because yeah, it helped with my doing the presentation. Thanks.
Okay. Okay, sorry, we don't have time for questions now because we just delayed a little bit. So if you have any more questions, you can find him at the coffee break, probably. And so please help yourself, have some coffee, eat something, and thanks.